Hello all, welcome to the God Said Most podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an independent anarchist press dedicated to publishing socially conscious literature. With me, as always, are the two other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. And today we are going to discuss Chris's pick, Thomas Pynchon's Against the Day, which is really just a giant novel. Shit, is it even a novel? That's something that I wonder about. Is this a novel? Certainly not in the traditional sense, but yeah, it's huge, it's daunting, and that said, there are passages where I'm just like, Jesus, this is great, this is fantastic. So, Chris, I'm going to turn it over to you, and you can talk about, you can talk about whatever you want.
I guess, like, it's not really possible to kind of give a summary of what happens in this book, but maybe some context. It starts with the World Columbia Exhibition in 1893 in Chicago, sort of a famous point in time. That's when electricity, like electric lights, were first displayed, and they were done so kind of as a vision of the future. The white city built outside of downtown Chicago, lit with lights, is sort of the vision of the future, and follows, I mean, maybe 100 characters or more through the decades leading up to World War One, and then kind of looking back immediately after World War One, very briefly at the end. But I'd say that kind of there's a lot of, I think, like threads that you could sort of like establish as sort of like the sort of a central or sort of like a reference point around which the rest are organized. The one that stuck out to me the most is maybe the most useful, I think, and you guys could disagree with me, would be the Travers family. And basically that follows Webb Travers first, who is a miner in Colorado, who is engaging in sabotage by detonating, using the dynamite to dig for ore, to basically attack like infrastructure and things that he sees as basically oppressing the working person. And he's eventually assassinated by the owners, or by specifically one owner, Scarsdale Vibe, because of that. And his sons, Frank, Reef, and Kit, who basically are, to me, like the kind of like the most easy to follow connective tissue throughout the rest of the novel, are basically finding themselves all over the world, following very different paths, sometimes crossing paths, but always seeking revenge against Scarsdale Vibe. And one of the things that is in this book is that tension between the working person and the owner, and a class tension, and anarchists, and the status quo, and that's, I don't know if I could build more on that. It just gets so complicated.
I do think that Webb Traverse is, even though he's not really, I mean, he dies a couple hundred pages into the novel, so he doesn't occupy a lot of narrative space. But I do think that he ties together some of the different... avenues of approach that you can use to kind of think about what's going on here in terms of theme and in terms of structure and craft, right? So I should say here, I read a series of essays about this novel, A Corrupted Pilgrim's Guide, it's called. And a lot of what was in the essays kind of reinforced thoughts I was already having, but I'm going to try to credit ideas from that book as much as possible. It's going to be pretty hard for me to talk about it, obviously, without some of those ideas, you know, bleeding into my own thoughts here. But one of the, you mentioned anarchism, Chris, right? And that is, I think, important both thematically and from a structure and craft standpoint here, right? The reason that it's important thematically, I think, is pretty clear. Pynchon is throughout all his work, and I've read all of his novels with varying depths of attention and consideration. And in some cases, it's been 10 years or more. But I've read everything of his, and in all of his work, to one extent or another, he's very concerned with the oppressive or totalizing force of government and the state, and also the kind of he links together the oppressive and totalizing force of government and the state and the kind of post Enlightenment rationalism and science, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And is instinctively critical and oppositional to that. There's a scene right at the beginning of the novel where another set of characters, the Chums of Chance, are looking from an airship down onto onto Chicago, right, when they're traveling to Chicago for the World's Fair in 1893. And they observe, and this is called out in one of the first essays in the collection that I read, but they observe the... basically, like, they observe the city as a series of like grids and rectangles and straight lines, each of which sort of from the sky you can see like gradually narrowing down and channeling to the approach chute that takes cows into the slaughterhouse in the Chicago stockyards, right? And so I think anarchism is... The idea of anarchism is obviously that's kind of a slippery term, right? But Pynchon, I think, is committed to some version of anarchism, both I think personally and in terms of the structures of the novel, right? And the way he structures his work. One of the complaints that a lot of people have made about this book, one thing that makes it difficult to track, is the plotting has a very kind of loose patchwork quality, and it's often not clear which characters are foreground and background characters, right? And there's a way in which the construction of the book resists the conventional novelistic structure, resists the kind of hierarchies of character and plot that are part of the value of conventional novels, right? And a lot of critics have tied that to Pynchon's fondness for anarchism, Pynchon's suspicion of structure, and his fondness for things like jazz, right? Which have a, like, jazz has somewhat of a structure, but also, you know, with it has kind of a structure that in the best cases arises organically through the real-time interplay of people, right? So, you know, I think Pynchon he's more inclined toward jazz societies, right? And to some extent, like, the kind of structural chaos and the chaos of the hundreds of characters or the dozens of characters in Against the Day is a way of trying to, or you could argue that it's a way of trying to create something like that in a novelistic framework. To some extent, all of his books do that, but it's much more so, Like, this is sort of the purest example of that, right?
Yeah, and he kind of, I think, like, he returns, it was something that I earmarked at the end, what I thought to be, like, a kind of a truly gorgeous passage about, I think about maybe Kit and Dally reconnecting, or maybe more generally about a tangent that a sort of a fantastical tangent of like make believe happiness that could follow the tragedy of World War One. And he's, you know, like, may we imagine for them a vector passing through the invisible, the imaginary, the unimaginable, carrying them safely into this post-war Paris, and on and on and on. But there's a passage in there. He says, music, which cannot be marched to, goes on uninterrupted all night in the bars and bal musettes for the dancers who will always be there. And the nights will be dark enough for whatever visions must transpire across them. And that music that cannot be marched to, is that, I mean, like, is that kind of like a resistance against structure that, like, creates that sort of, that order that, in, that with time and science and capitalism eventually coalesces into some kind of oppression? Or is, if I'm just kind of going off of what you're saying, like, with jazz.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, I think that, I don't think that Pynchon isn't necessarily against any form of structure or society, right? He's against structures and societies which depend on coercion for their existence and their order. And so music that cannot be marched to, right? It's a good eye to catch that phrase, I think, because music that cannot be marched to, you know, it has some sense of structure and order, but it's structure that arises through, or order that arises through something other than coercion, right? Through engagement, through passion. The around the same time that that phrase is invoked, I mentioned him a little while ago, but one of the threads, one of the sets of characters and narrative threads in the novel is around a group of airship pilots called the Chums of Chance, right? Who are these kind of boys adventure dime store characters.
Hardy Boys
or
in the Sky.
Dime novel characters. Yeah, Hardy Boys in the Sky. Maybe a bit older than the Hardy Boys. But the Chums of Chance, at the end of the novel, they've kind of advanced into, they've sort of built this, like, high-tech eco-paradise in the sky, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of like a version of that same idea, right, of orders which occur somewhat spontaneously through through kind of collective improvisation, rather than top-down orders that are enforced by coercion. Which, Patrick, you, of the three of us, you're, I think, by far the best versed in anarchism, and probably the most committed to the ideas of it. I don't know if you had any thoughts about how, politically, how anarchism is used or considered in this novel, and how that kind of might tie in with some of the structural choices.
Yeah, that was a huge question that I was asking myself. You know, on the one hand, we have anarchism just as part of the milieu, because, you know, the late 19th, early 20th is when anarchists are, you know, kind of top of form. You know, they're most active and you know, the most visible in culture. And, you know, we've got the things like the Haymarket riots and the murder of the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and all that kind of stuff. So
McKinley, yeah.
Yeah. And I was wondering, you know, so it's clear to me that the novel is interested not just in anarchism as part of its milieu, but anarchism as an idea. And you know, I definitely got the idea that anarchism, like it's a proponent of anarchism, even though we've got these little fun little jests and things like somewhere there's an anarchist golf course. Like
Yeah.
okay. You know, not which isn't to say that some anarchists interested in golfing couldn't come together and put up a golf course, but you know, an anarchist golf course kind of seems like a contradiction in terms. And then there's s one character point says that anarchism and organization are a contradiction in terms, which is, you know, something that almost every anarchist I think would disavow. So it was clear to me that there's this interest in anarchism, but I definitely didn't have a good idea of what the novel was saying about anarchism. But your discussion about anarchism and structure makes sense to me. You know, that makes a lot of sense to me that you know, the novel is through its form trying to criticize hierarchical structures. Though I do admit I'm s more of a I tend to think of myself as a classical anarchist, you know, in the lines of Kropotkin, Bakunin, and Proudhon. And they, you know, for them, the anarchism was almost totally a political thing. It wouldn't have gone over into the moral or scientific. It wouldn't necessarily have bled over into these other disciplines. You know, so
Sure.
for Kropotkin, science could be objective and as could morality. You know, these things could be objective to Kropotkin, but I don't necessarily think that's true for Pynchon. And I, you know,
Right.
that was something that I was trying to wrap my head around. You
No,
know,
it's oh, sorry.
what?
Well, I was gonna say it's anarchy is epistemological. In this, it's like it
Yeah.
undoes how
Right,
we know.
exactly. And yeah, anarchy is epistemological in this novel, and that's not something, you know, my favorite anarchists aren't epistemological anarchists, and I don't consider myself an epistemological anarchist. And so that's definitely something that, you know, I'm interested in knowing more about, because I feel like now, if other anarchists would probably hear this and say, you're disgusting or you're a piece of shit or whatever. But on some level, I do think anarchism requires some objective normativity. You know, just because if we're going to say that hierarchical forms of organization are awful, and if we're going to fight against them, then, you know, we kind of have to hold the position that that is an objective truth. So that's something that I'm interested in, and I wonder what you guys think about, like what
Well,
this novel says about that.
yeah, I mean, I think you're touching on a couple of things that, to get a little more personal, a couple of things that I've struggled with in reading and appreciating Pynchon, right? Because I reread, so his most famous novel, Gravity's Rainbow, is one of my favorite novels, and I've read it a few times, and I reread it last winter, I believe, and one thing that it seems to that Gravity's Rainbow and Against the Day, one thematic idea that they have is sort of this is maybe sort of a crude way to say it, right? But at the time that I read Gravity's Rainbow, that I most recently reread Gravity's Rainbow, it seemed to me like it edges into a sort of like hippie anti-rationalism that's not too far maybe from like anti-vax culture or something like that.
Mm.
Right. And it's and I don't think Pynchon I'm not saying at all that Pynchon's anti-vax. To my knowledge, right. He's never made any comment one way or the other. Right.
Sure.
But the hostility that Gravity's Rainbow in particular has toward scientific and rational lines of thought and being is it edges into it can edge into some unsavory stuff. Right. And the same is true, I think, to some extent of all of his work. You used the phrase, Chris, epistemological anarchism. Right.
Yeah,
and
which is really good. Really good phrase. I like that.
That was great. Yeah. And I think that captures some of what, as much as I love Pynchon's writing, sentence by sentence level, paragraph level, as much as I love most of what's in his books, some part of me is a little bit resistant to that approach, to that aspect of what I think is there. Although you can find at least isolated areas where people kind of, there are positive technologies, right? There are positive uses of science. There are positive technologies. The unfortunate thing is that most of those are fictional. right, like the chums of chance at the end, when they build their airship into a floating city, most of the technologies that they use to avoid consuming fossil fuels are fictional technologies, right? They surf light, right? There's a technology that one character uses toward the end of essentially taking a photograph and extrapolating it forward and backward to turn it into a movie, right? So, for instance, you can take a photo. One of the characters takes a photograph of his estranged daughter and runs it forward to see her as she is now. And that there's kind of a beauty in the way that that technology is presented. But again, it's not a real technology, right? And the technologies that do, when Pynchon engages with science and technology as it exists in the quote-unquote real world, there's almost always what to me seems to be a kind of instinctive hostility, a way of kind of extrapolating the political idea of what, maybe to touch on what you were saying, of extrapolating the political idea of anarchism into realms like the you know, scientific rationalism or objective truth, which is
right.
I just can't, at a personal level, I don't really necessarily agree with, and it takes me a little bit out of the work from the standpoint of appreciation.
Interesting.
The other thing that bugs me too about Pynchon is he's famously very conspiratorially minded, right? He's famously very conspiratorially minded, and he tends to, you know, it's very hard in a Pynchon novel to distinguish between like his assertions about what's really happening in our lived world versus his kind of fictional fancies to sum up the spirit of a thing, right? Presumably most of what happens in a Pynchon novel isn't necessarily an assertion of literal historical truth, right? Obviously. But what I'm getting at with this is like his most recent novel, The Bleeding Edge. I read that when it came out, and it has some 9/11 conspiracy stuff in it, right? It has some 9/11 was an inside job kind of stuff in it. And I found that very off-putting because, you know, I don't have any emotional connection to a conspiracy theory that says that World War I was deliberately staged to reinforce the nation state, right? I mean, I guess on some level you could argue that it was in some sense, you know, much of the motivation to do World War I instead of just shrug and not do World War I had to do probably with reinforcing the norms and the glorification of the nation state, right? But in Pynchon's world, there's basically like a big building with a giant file cabinet full of all the papers around the carefully organized plot for World War I, right? And I think that that, to some extent, is that conspiracy, that urge to see historical events as having been maliciously plotted by national actors in detail is an extension of that anti-rationalism, right? If order is evil, then events which happen in the world have to, then terrible events which happen in the world have to be read as the actions of hierarchical, the orderly actions of hierarchical agencies, rather than what I tend to think they are, which is fundamentally chaos and chance, right? So, you know, I think that you can make a connection between, maybe paradoxically, you can make a connection between Pynchon's instinctive dislike of grids and structures and order and linear time and his urge to see most world history as being conspiratorially orchestrated, right? Mm. And those two things are two things that on an emotional level I have trouble connecting with in the books, much as I enjoy many other things about them.
I'm a little more sympathetic to the, I guess, like the I guess fragmentation, or I keep on going back to what I was calling it, but you know, epistemological anarchism. But you said something to do with rationalism that
anti-rationalism,
at least in this novel, because I feel like it's of a time. I've just been actually, I happen to be like circling this time a lot recently in things that I've been reading. So I was reading a nonfiction book about the World Columbia. Is it exhibition or exposition? Exhibition.
I think it's exposition.
Exposition. Thank you. And also about the beginning of vaccinations and the Spanish or the 1918 flu. But it's such an interesting time because the tools of rational inquiry are finally available, finally widely available, and everyone is suddenly engaging in science, but they don't have the lexicon yet. And so the result is this really fragmented, kind of insane, collage of different ideas of what could be true. Mm-hmm. And we start with this idea of the ether in this book, you know, which preceded, which was dismissed by general relativity. And there's tons of them that have, you know, some basis or have some history that, you know, maybe there's some that are just sort of inserted in there. Like, I don't think that people really believed that if you, you know, did things a certain way, you'd become invisible or, you know, necessarily like transport from one place to another. But maybe they did, because there was this promise of science and of unlocking the mysteries of the world without the weight of scientific history pressing down from the past. And I feel sympathetic to the wonder of that period and kind sure. of like, and really kind of celebrating that. It isn't like that, you know, I guess like there is no separation in this novel between things that actually did manifest as like real, you know, applications of science and like the photograph that you mentioned, Hans. They're all kind of just, for this brief moment in time, possible. And that's really evident when there's a long bit of the novel, which means that it's like one tenth of a percent of the entire novel, but it's actually like long, that he spends on the Tunguska event. The meteor that crashed into Siberia.
It wasn't a meteor. It was a
Quaternion.
No, it wasn't a Quaternion. It was the X-File aliens.
Uh-huh.
You know, they were trying to activate the oil virus, the black oil virus.
You guys are being perfect right now. This is. The different ideas about what actually happened, you know, because people observed it all over the world, and it was
a meteor.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I mean, I don't think that I remember, unless like I went to sleep last night and then woke up in a different universe, Shambhala perhaps. But I'm pretty sure it was a meteor in real life,
right?
In real history. I didn't actually look that up. You guys are messing with me. It is a meteor.
No,
right?
It was. It was a meteor. It exploded about 10 miles off the ground. It didn't actually hit, and it sent out a big shockwave. Although the X-Files did use it for a really interesting storyline.
Well, using it for different storylines. I just think that I'm sympathetic to that folks. to that kind of. And it seems to be because one of the essays from the only essay that I read from that book that I had time to read, Hans, was that first one.
The one about genre?
Yeah. Pynchon choosing to write these different vignettes that are all kind of strung together throughout this period of time, choosing to use the kind of adventure, thriller, like genre styles. Of the period that sort of reflect the content, you know. So like if it's following Cyprian and Reef and Yash in the Balkans, it's like kind of spy novel-y and
it seemed just like porno to me.
Yeah, it was very, that was some pretty pretty awesome stuff, but also borrowing that textuality, but also borrowing the kind of really schizophrenic scientific textuality of the time, like where these things are true. It kind of reminded me of what Charles Baxter wrote about in The Art of Subtext. When you're writing, you should allow your characters to just do stuff.
Sure.
Like when, you know, when a normal human being, when someone in reality would not like just like stand up in the bar and reach across it and grab the bartender and like choke him out, you know, maybe a fictional character does that because it's fiction. That's what fiction is for. And Pynchon seems to be taking that to a text of reality level. Like these things might as well be true because the people in the time believe them. And so it kind of allows this, like these different characters to follow really remarkably rich tangents of inquiry with like the natural world and like what's possible scientifically and just allowing it to be the case. And then all of it kind of ending. I mean, with World War One. I mean, that's like,
well, and I think that, I mean, I want to, before I say this, I want to put a pin in the genre stuff, because I think there's a lot to talk about there, and I want to make sure we cover that. That being said, though, I mean, I if I'm understanding part of what you're saying, I think this is another thing where you can, to some extent, tie in a couple different thematic elements, because what you're describing, in some sense, makes the book sort of an elegy for like a particular era at the beginning of the kind of widespread, a particular era of possibility, right? You have, in the realm of science, you have a particular era when an enormous range of things could turn out to be scientifically possible, which to a great extent eventually did not turn out to be, or as of yet seem not to have turned out to be, right? Things like time travel or bilocation or traveling between parallel universes and some more mundane things too. You have this kind of this, in some sense, the book is an elegy for that sense of possibility around early science, and then also an elegy for the sense of possibility around some political order existing beyond hierarchical capitalism and social orders enforced through violence, right? And World War One.
You think the book's got that defeatist attitude? At least as far as...
I don't think it necessarily has a totally defeatist attitude, no, but I do think that one of the ideas of the book is that there was a sense of great possibility both in political terms, in terms of political structure and in terms of scientific possibility. There was this particular kind of radical sense of possibility in both realms prior to World War One that we understand now as, you know, observers in our particular moment, did not pan out in the way many of those people would have hoped for in the aftermath of World War One. And I certainly, sure. I don't think that, ultimately, I don't think Pynchon is a pessimist, right? I mean, I think that at the level of individuals, most of the characters actually end up coming to hopeful ends in one way or another, right?
Yeah, it seems like everybody, you know, maybe not the picture perfect happy ending, but most of them seem...
But by the same token, too, I mean, it, you can identify that optimism and still, I think, also recognize the ways that there's a sense of possibility in the world that's portrayed at the beginning of the book that is, to a great extent, that has to kind of be, that's snuffed to one extent or another by World War One, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't read the end as... I read the end as very... sweet and sad, and for some of, you know, like Reef and, you know, the Travers brothers, who kind of are, I guess, like, my impression is, squeezed up to Alaska because they just don't fit in the rest of the world. That's not said explicitly, but it's like they just, at the very beginning of the novel, you talk about the chums of chance in the air, and I think it's Professor Vanderjuice who's with them, who's just saying, like, yep, there it is, that's the end of the frontier, it's all over, you know, like, it's all been kind of wrung out. And, you know, this kind of very non-traditional family is, you know, I guess they have each other, but it does kind of feel like there's not a, like, I don't know. I felt like it was sweet and then sad. Dally kind of talks to that one character who says, you know, we're all in hell. You know, like, we all died the whole world ended in 1914. And I was kind of not convinced by that, but I understood. I felt sadness for the death of whatever we were seeing that came before. Sorry, Patrick.
Well, I'm interested in how it ends for Reef and Yashmin and their kind of extended family, because to my mind, this is the core of the principle of anarchist communism, which is that, you know, we live in a small enough group where we can reach consensus-based decisions rather than, what some people call democracy, which is, you know, majority vote wins. And so on that level, that seemed very hopeful to me, that the kind of core organization of the anarchists, the commune, could remain intact.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that the if salvation can't happen at the social level, then Pynchon maybe suggests that it can happen at the individual level, right? For all of its for all of its kind of psychosexual weirdness, in many ways, this ends up being a very pro-family novel, right?
Right.
And maybe
right,
not
right,
quite within the conventional sense of family, not necessarily within a dogmatic
right,
nuclear family sense of family, but really, actually, yeah, within that. Like the I mentioned genre earlier, right? And one thing that happens, one thing that the Traverse family essentially start out in a version of the Western, right?
Right.
Particularly around a revenge plot. And over the course of the novel, the whole idea of like the Western revenge plot more and more and more falls apart and disintegrates. And
right,
the, and you know, the what ends up happening is that like over time, the all the kind of Westernized trappings, Westernized meaning Western genre trappings of their lives, sort of disintegrate and spin themselves off, and they end up in this kind of sweet early middle-aged contentment, right?
Mm.
Not really even through any conscious decision, so much as it seems to me, so much as just kind of through through chance and instinct, right? But that,
right,
but that, you know, being able to exist with relative independence in a family structure seems to be as close to redemptive as anything that can really happen.
Right.
Not Lake.
In this world or for these characters. Not Lake. Not Lake. No.
Right.
Not
yeah,
Lake,
yeah,
and
Lake.
Deuce. That
Lake
is
and
some nightmare stuff. Like,
yeah,
that is written. I think that was the darkest. It
I'm
felt
glad, I'm
so
glad we
bleak.
Got to find out. I'm glad we got to find out what happened to Lake, though, because her. I liked her story a lot, and then we left it for like a bazillion pages, and I was
yeah,
like, I hope we get to find that out. But before we move on, I'd really like to talk about this idea of family and, you know, how it might be related to anarchist communism, and how it's maybe both subverted and supported at the same time. So I'm going to bring up that little anecdote that I was talking about before that
yeah,
I said I would wait till later. So we've got, so probably I think that there are some early parts of the novel that seemed where we were really talking about how shitty capitalism is and how they're the, you know, this capitalism is intricately linked with the state, and I liked all that stuff. But I thought this might have been my favorite part of the novel, where we form this kind of triune marriage, borrowing a term from a sci-fi novel by Dan Simmons. We've got this like triune marriage between Reef, Cyprian, and Yashmin, right? And there seemed more to it than just like a sexual. Like, it wasn't just a sexual relationship, right? It seemed like each member was needed, because when Cyprian goes off to the nunnery,
mm-hmm,
you know, Reef and Yashmin, like, there seems to be some turmoil and some question of whether their relationship is going to end. But, of course, then at the end of the novel, we get, you know, the hopeful, you know, maybe they can kind of keep on going in this larger, possibly
polyamorous.
Yeah, possibly polyamorous relationship within this commune style thing. So that was something I wondered about. But I think the reason I liked it so much was because Cyprian's relationship between Reef and Yashmin, to me, felt exactly like my subjective experience of this novel. So as I was saying, right, so Reef and Yashmin and Cyprian are all having sex together, right? So Cyprian is filleting Reef, and Reef ejaculates into Cyprian's mouth. And then Yashmin says, "Don't you dare swallow that, crawl over like a dog, and, you know, perform cunnilingus on me and, you know, give me Reef's semen," right? And I thought, man, that is what reading this novel is. It's a mix of like pure like animal pleasure, like like, I can totally imagine myself as Cyprian, you know, really enjoying that. Like, just having gotten somebody ejaculated into my mouth, and then I go over and give it to, you know, Yashmin. But it's also, like, utter degradation, right? It's like one at the same time, like pure animal pleasure from being degraded. Did that ring true with anybody reading this?
That definitely does ring true. It also, I think for me, if I were to pick a Reef sex scene that really kind of summed up my sense of my relationship to the novel, I think it might actually be when he tries to get the dog to fillet him.
Oh, yeah. He tries to get the dog to fillet him, yeah. Holy shit.
Yeah, there's a character. So there's a character named Ruperta Chirpingdon Groin, who's sort of like a vapid, decadent aristocrat.
And yeah. Originally, Reef was getting with her, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Because she kept him fed, I think, right? He's just basically kind of a bum at that point.
He's kind of a bum, yeah, yeah. And so Ruperta Chirpingdon Groin has a French miniature poodle. And she she leaves Reef with this miniature poodle. And Reef somehow has the idea that this miniature poodle has been performing cunnilingus on Ruperta Chirpingdon Groin, and gets very, very, he feels like he sees like a sparkle in the dog's eyes that says, that is indeed what I do, and I'm really drooling for one of them penises. You know, I really want a change. I want to try my tricks out on a different thing, you know? And he's very, very excited, and then it bites his penis.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I felt about, you know, approaching this novel.
Sure, sure, sure.
I think I'm in love with this novel. I really am. I didn't feel like my genitalia suffered in any way.
I don't know. It's like this is just, it was. Like I say, I want to be positive because, you know, this novel is really fantastic. You know, as I said when you first talked about it, you know, I loved it on a sentence level, and there are just passages, not only written passages but also vignettes that really just blow me away. Though, God, could we lose maybe 70% of it?
Do you,
I mean, like, not really, you, but you yeah. know what I'm saying. Like, it's so long, and the narratives are so intertwined. It's just hard to get your head around.
Let's ask that question in a more structured way. Like, could we do without the Chums of Chance? Because, like, they are a perspective on goings. I mean, like, what they're not. They don't really. Are they the right person, the right characters to isolate for this? I feel like I love them. I think that the whole like messy, like the messiness of this novel is something that I enjoy.
Mm.
You know, I'm just trying to reach for something that like specific, like the Chums of Chance. You know, that we begin and end with them,
right?
And then
I mean theirs was the narrative I definitely understood the least. Like, I didn't know why it was there, right?
Yeah.
Like, I get, like, the Travers family is connected by this, you know, this possible revenge plot. And, you know, seeing what they do, what each member does, I get that. But definitely, like, what are the Chums of Chance doing? I don't get it exactly.
Well, I can think of a couple things that they're doing. And, you know, whether or not they're necessary to achieve these things, I think, is maybe another question, right? But I can at least point to a couple of purposes that I think they serve. We talked a little bit, but didn't really go into depth about the idea of genre, right? And I should actually probably in the book that I read, the first essay, and I think the one that maybe did the most to unlock the, like, if I had to pick one essay to read that unlocked what's happening here, In terms of writing techniques, I think maybe this essay, Genre as History, Pynchon's Genre Poaching by Brian McHale, might have been like the one that did the most for me in reading the collection. But what McHale asserts basically, and other critics have put forward versions of this, but I think McHale really kind of chases it down in the most depth, is that each of the main segments or threads of the novel is a version, like starts out as a version of the genre, starts out as a version of a form of genre fiction that would have been written at the time the novel takes place, right?
Mm, okay.
So the Tom Swift-style boys' adventure dime novel is represented by the Chums of Chance. And the first few pages of the first Chums of Chance section, which are also the opening of the novel, are very explicitly written as a genre parody, right? There are all these like detail level markers of style that really like are a flashing red sign. This is a genre parody. And that, I mean, you couldn't do that for 1,000 pages because it would be unreadable even by the generous standards of a book like this, right? But but that the way in which they are used at the beginning really kind of telegraphs that writing technique in a way that frames the rest of that kind of teaches you how to think about how things like the Western and the spy novel are used over the course of the rest of the novel, right? So that's one function that they serve. I think also so there's a sense in which the Chums of Chance are like an extra level of fictional within the realm of the novel, right? They kind of exist in this weird sort of halfway kind of limbic state where they are... Even though they exist within the world of the novel and interact to some extent with some of the characters, they're also understood to, in a fundamental way, kind of be book characters within the world of the novel, right?
They literally are book characters, right? Doesn't Frank or Reef or someone read a comics about them?
Yes, yeah.
Right.
Reads their books, yeah.
Right.
So, you know, because they have that extra level of fictionality, they're not really tied in the same way that the other characters are to history as it occurs in our world. And so they're able to live out this construction of an idealized society that at the end of the novel, they're able to kind of live out this development into an idealized Pynchonian society that nobody in the real world really can, right? So they kind of have the latitude to carry out the ideals of the novel at a level of perfection that real people can't. So, I mean, that's thematically and structurally they do some pretty heavy lifting. Now certainly, you know, is there a version of that you could do with, you know, other characters? Probably so. Just at an aesthetic level, I mean, I read this the first time I read this was 10 years ago, and with 10 years of distance, most of the images and scenes and moments that stuck in my head were Chums of Chance material, right? They have a kind of there's a stickiness to them that is, for me, was a bit more so over the long term than some of the more grounded material. So I think, you know, we've talked a lot about how like there are a lot of things that many critics have perceived as being structural weaknesses, right, or aesthetic weaknesses of this novel that are also kind of thematic ideas being carried out in structure, right? And
right.
The extent to which Pynchon commits to that, I think, is inevitably going to very, very much limit the audience it can reach and limit the number of people who will finish it or enjoy it, really. And I think also at the same time, it's difficult to imagine reducing that commitment without harming the spirit of the novel somehow, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there are many, many, many novels with conventional plotting and psychologically well-developed characters. There's not, I don't think, a shortage of that in the world, right?
Sure.
But there's only one Against the Day.
Interesting. I mean, that definitely makes me appreciate the novel more. Like, I
do think that it is very easy to, I mean, I read 40 pages a day of this novel for about 5 weeks, right? And if I'd had to read it sooner for a deadline, like to write a review or to talk about it in a class, I would have maybe started to, I think it's easy to dismiss if you don't allow yourself to live in it at a kind of high level. It's very easy to dismiss if you, and I think it would also be easy to dismiss if I, you know, there were some days I thought, well, I'm going to read 80 pages today so that I have, you know, more time tomorrow to clean the house. And then I would just, it would lose me beyond a certain point.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to dismiss if you don't read it at just the right pace and with just the right spirit.
It's such an, because I feel like it's such an accomplishment for being enjoyable, like on a micro level, in order to make progression through the macro level, those 40 pages, you're pretty much guaranteed to have something that makes you crack up, or, you know, is kind of weird, definitely like totally strange, or like, you know, did people actually believe that, or like, is that actually a real place? You know, it's so rich, like. It's kind of a contradiction, because it actually it's extraordinarily long, but it actually is written so with so much, you know, packed into the tiny moments that, like, it can be read that way. And that was something that kind of surprised me, kind of coming back and doing what you were doing, Hans, that I was like, it was sort of like practicing violin or something like that. I was like, oh my God, I have to pick up this book. And it's so long. But then as soon as I was reading it, I was like, oh, this is great. You know, like, this is awesome. Like, just like every single little thing, you know, like, I'm trying to think of, like, I think I kind of felt a little bit like I don't really understand what was going on with the twit. Like, I just don't understand. I think I just didn't pick up the right threads. And so, like, the Grant Cohen and all of that. And so there were things that just felt like they just didn't make buckets for me. But I just, you know, I think that maybe I missed stuff. And, but no, that was something I really was amazed by, because, like, this is not a book that propels you forward with plot at all, like, at all. And for it to be so enjoyable on a line level is amazing. I don't know how you do that. So I'm kind of amazed by this book.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's easy both to underrate and to oversell in a way, right? Like, like all these reviews on the back jacket of, at least my copy, right? Like, rich and sweeping, wild and thrilling. Well, I guess in some sense maybe so, but, you know, a lot of people are going to see that and pick it up expecting to get, like, Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry, right? And, like, get about 5 pages, right? Or I don't know if your copy has this particular blurb, but one of the blurbs on my copy is audacious, bodacious, entropic, synoptic, electric, eclectic, entertaining, hyperbraining, high roller, tripolar, by Against the Day. Like, that's not technically wrong, but there's a way that it's being sold that, like, is completely at odds with the real experience of reading it, right? And you have to figure that whoever wrote that blurb for the Philadelphia Inquirer maybe read about 10 pages of it and thought, geez, I got to pretend I like this to look smart, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm.
There's no way to market this book. I don't think there's a single way that you can market this book.
There's no honest way that you can market this book without eliminating the audience to the point where the only people who read it were people whose favorite book is Gravity's Rainbow, right?
I think because the book is so much about the experience of it and not anything, you know, and about, you know, like jazz. You know, jazz is, you want to listen to jazz live, you know, and experience it. And it's like you don't do a mixtape of your favorite jazz songs. People listen to jazz albums. And
right. And if you listen to a jazz album waiting for the catchy chorus to come back around, you're going to be disappointed and miss the point.
Yeah.
Yeah. We mentioned when we did the Goldfinch, I can't remember how explicitly I said this or if I've said something like this on another podcast, right? But like when I read the Goldfinch, I realized that I was coming back to the novel. I was coming back to the Goldfinch every time I sat down to continue reading it, to a great extent, just kind of motivated by raw curiosity about what was going to happen next, right? And I realized that I had come to view that as like a dirty and corrupt and low way to enjoy a book, right? That like, not only was I not used to reading something with a pleasure that was mainly derived from plot-based suspense, but that I actually felt rather gross doing that, you know, that I kind of had it in the same mental category as like jerking off to Pornhub. And I hadn't realized how much I'd internalized that idea. It was something I'd kind of probably built up over the entirety of my 20s and hadn't realized how much I had built it up until I read The Goldfinch and had such a strong experience with that kind of plot-based suspense, right? And I feel like a large part of that attitude was probably built up by things like reading Against the Day with the belief that like this is about as good as novels get. So if this is in the complete vacuum of plot-based suspense, then it must be that plot-based suspense is worthless, right? So I suppose there are probably, maybe not Against the Day particularly, because I don't actually remember much about reading it the first time, but like it's very emblematic of the type of book that probably taught me a certain kind of snobbery that took a long time to unlearn after grad school. Mm-hmm. And so I can see why some people hate it for that reason, right?
I think that's totally fair. I mean, I think that the kind of how much of an asshole do you have to be to just sort of put this in a publisher's hands, like really kind of like yeah, sell that, you know, like, and just, you know, smug, you know, there's only, I mean, like there's kind of what, like,
well,
what is it, cashing in, like when some like movie star makes a completely absurd, really like total like passion project, like there's only a few people alive, few writers alive who could possibly have gotten this book like published,
right?
And
yeah like if you know let's say that this book is a masterpiece, let's say it is, I mean, I'm sure you two agree, but somebody else, some no name writes it, you know, this doesn't get published at all.
Exactly
yeah
yeah. And for what it's worth, I mean, There are habits here and characteristics here that are present to one extent or another in Pynchon's other work, but that are maximized here in a way that they're not at all in really any of his other books, right? Even Gravity's Rainbow, for as famously challenging as it is, it does have a clear protagonist who goes through an arc, right? And who you spend the majority of the novel with your protagonist, and you can easily say what's happened to him by the end of the book, right? So it's Or like Mason and Dixon, you know, the relationship between those two characters, Mason and Dixon, is kind of rich and complex in this very conventional characterological way that doesn't really occur in Against the Day, right? So it's there's a certain kind of set of habits and ideas that's carried to an extreme here that,
well,
that does require, I think, a certain kind of, arrogance, I guess, right? To say, okay, like I'm going to write an 1100 page novel with essentially no reading momentum deriving from plot or character, where probably the best thing about it is just the quality of writing at a paragraph level, right?
That's,
and again, like I don't know that I would call it, I mean, the term masterpiece is kind of overused to the point of meaninglessness now, right? But it is a masterpiece in the sense that it is, the things that are most characteristically Pynchonian are carried to their maximal extent here, right? Mm.
Interesting.
Can I just a sort of a self-centered anecdote about one of the kind of old antiquated scientific terms here? Can I digress with that? One thing that is you mentioned this a couple times, Chris, right? That most of the scientific characters in this novel still believe in the concept of the ether, right? Which, as I understood it, was, so around the turn of the century, it was theorized that in the way that a sound wave moves through air and is carried by the medium of air, light must be an equivalent wave moving through some other sort of medium that is equivalent to how air works to conduct sound, right? Or water, if you're underwater, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that medium that conducted light was thought to be the ether, right? And there were all these experiments that were meant to determine the nature or the existence of the ether. So, and of course, you know, as you mentioned, Chris, general relativity made the ether irrelevant. And so I was, as you guys know, I don't talk about this that often because it just didn't really, in the long term, probably I don't think have that much of an impact on me, but I was raised as a Baha'i. And
what?
The Baha'i faith, it's a religion.
What?
I was raised in the Baha'i faith.
Holy shit. I didn't know that.
Oh, well,
cool. Go on.
Yeah, so one of the things, and the Baha'i Faith, I mean, in many ways, as far as like conventional dogmatically oriented religions go, it's certainly one of the less objectionable ones, right?
Mm.
It has sort of like a, there's this kind of, it's very anti-pleasure, right? Like it's to some extent derived from, Baha'is would be mad if I said this, but to some extent it's kind of a post-Islamic faith, right? And it has the same sort of suspicion of pleasure that a lot of Islam has.
Mm.
And so I couldn't go back to it now for that reason, right?
But, right, exactly.
I mean, it's like...
Yeah, you could not... Hans, that's not for you anymore.
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's not. One of the things that's commendable about the Baha'i faith is it strives to maintain harmony with science, right? It's a very pro-science religion.
Mm.
And so, for instance, you know, Baha'is believe in evolution, right? In the same way that the Catholic Church does, where the scientific record is held to be a literal account of what happened in the history of the universe, right?
Right.
So when I was about 13, like I was, when I say I was raised as a Baha'i, like it wasn't something we thought about or talked about that much. And we only went to services occasionally, right? Like the way that many, I suppose, American Christians relate to their faith. But when I was about 13, I thought, okay, like I was kind of in search of an identity and a crowd. And I thought, all right, well, I'm going to really get into these Baha'i texts, right? And I'm going to start going to Baha'i services more. And I'm going to really kind of engage with my religion. And I happened to also be studying the history of physics at the time. I was reading this Asimov book about that. So I knew what the ether was. I knew the history of the idea of the ether. And so I pick up this book, and it has a lecture from one of the prophets of the Baha'i faith where he's talking about the importance of harmonizing religion with science. And he starts talking about the ether and like, yep, those scientists, they really have it when they tell you about the ether. They're spot on there. The ether was created by God. And it was like this weird irony, because it's like, okay, I know that you're trying to use your scientific, you're trying to use your scientific literacy to make yourself seem more credible. And with 100 years hindsight, what you've done is completely demolish your credibility as someone with a line to God, right?
Mm.
And I hadn't thought about that in decades until I read this book, and there are all these characters talking about the ether, right? Because the Baha'i faith was formed around the time that is captured here in Against the Day, and in some ways I think had some of the same kind of naive utopian instincts as maybe some of the anarchist characters. Not that it's an anarchist faith, but it came from that same kind of like pre-World War One excitement, you know.
We can design something that lifts us up out of our current condition. It is a problem that is solvable, it being suffering and inequity and
wait, what? There have been plenty of equal stateless anarchist societies in history. So what the hell are you talking about, Chris?
I'm saying that there was a period of time. And said, no, I'm not. There's a period of time when, I don't know what you're laughing about. I don't know what you're asking me for, actually.
Well, you seem to just claim that inequity is a like a constant of human existence, and that's not true.
I do think it is. I think that it is
Need to read more.
Engaging with the problem is an act of reclamation, like in Waterland. It is something that we constantly.
All right, Chris, do me a favor and read the book Anarchy Works by Peter Gelderloos.
Sounds pretty biased to me.
Well, it is biased, but it's it's historically accurate.
I think well, this is obviously not part of the examination of the text, but we could litigate it at some other point.
I just feel like now I have to like force you to read this.
That doesn't sound very in tune with your beliefs, but
no, it doesn't.
Forcing somebody
to read it is not anarchist. I absolutely agree.
No, I'm giving you a hard time. We can talk about that some other time. No, I'd love to.
We're never going to talk about it unless I force you.
This is an impasse.
Yeah, I think it is an impasse. Anyway, what did I derail here?
Oh, nothing. I think we were at a nice kind of...
Right.
I had finished my dumb self-centered anecdote and briefly tied it back to Against the Day, in an obligatory sort of way.
Were there Baha'i characters in Against the Day? There were, right?
No. I don't think
was
so.
Was it mentioned?
Not that I recall. I don't think it was mentioned, no.
Huh.
It did come into existence in the 1870s, 1880s.
I feel like I just heard about
roughly
the Baha'i faith.
Roughly the 1880s to the turn of the century, yeah.
Yeah, so it fits.
Yeah.
Is Baha'i mentioned in Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?
It might be. There is a Philip K. Dick novel called Eye in the Sky that has some references to some stuff that doesn't really make sense if you're not familiar with the history of the Baha'i faith.
Okay.
I can't really explain it without getting into annoying detail, but
sure.
There, at least in that novel, Philip K. Dick is. I know he was conversant with the idea of Baha'i.
Okay, I think I've gotten it mixed up then, because I finished Against the Day a couple days ago, but I started listening to Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep also a few days ago, and I think I got it mixed up. Okay.
No, and just because, like, you mentioned bringing up the Baha'i, I do feel like, I don't know, like, there's this thing about, like, do we live in a less rich world, like, mythologically, than we used to? Is nostalgia for this period of time where you could search for answers in ancient texts and try and assemble or design from, like, or look for, like, truth, like finding Shambhala or finding a lost city, or like there's actually a physical place that exists where, like, people are delivered, or looking into the future from this time, you know, like, we will, you know, like, it'll actually be science that lifts us up, or some combination of, like, our ancient past, our ancient, you know, like, mysterious past and this rich, mysterious future. And, like, do we live in that world anymore? Or did that world ever exist? Or, like, is Pynchon just sort of, like, making me miss something that never was?
I don't know.
I broke you. I broke you both.
Well, I don't know. It's... I mean, I think that Pynchon, and this is an area where there's probably a difference between, like, how I personally feel and how Pynchon feels, right? I mean, I certainly think that Pynchon is interested in encounters with mystery and sacredness, right? And the question of where that can be found, and views the modern rationalist scientific order as being hostile to encounters with sacredness and mystery, right? And to the question of whether or not Pynchon thinks we'd be better off to live in an era where that was possible, I don't know. I mean, you can't, right? So to some extent, that's kind of an irrelevant question.
Yeah.
I think the idea of that loss is certainly a core concern of how he thinks about the world.
Cool. Thanks.
Well, that seems like a good wrap up. Do you guys have any last thoughts or comments about the book before we go on?
For my part, I mean, your guy's initial discussion about, like, structure and its relationship to anarchism, that was very enlightening. And I think that, like, I didn't know much about, like, the genre parody stuff. So on that level, the book didn't really hit me, but your discussion on structure was definitely illuminating. So I felt like it made me appreciate the novel more. So I thought that was important to kind of reiterate.
I had one other question. I don't know if it goes anywhere other than, like, Pynchon just decided that this was how he's going to do it. But, like, why did Scarsdale Vibe take on Kit? And what it was the nature? Like, he goes off on that rant about, like, crushing these anti-status quo anarchists, and that being, like, his, like, people, like basically, like, a calling. I just didn't know, like, but I just didn't understand. I didn't understand that central tension, which I guess is pretty glaring problem for the book. But I just accepted it and moved on. Like, okay, why are you paying for kids' education in Europe? I don't know.
Because I think that the text suggests a couple different reasons. It suggests in conversation between Vibe and his assistant Foley Walker, my recollection is that it's suggested that is essentially perceived as a way of neutralizing Kit, right?
But why don't you just kill
tie him? Well, because.
He does want science.
Because
I know that, but, like, anyway.
Well, I think the reason that you don't just kill Kit is because that's not a wise use of a potentially fruitful resource, right? I mean, from Vive's perspective, if you want to kill him, you can kill him anytime you want to, really, right?
Mm.
So you essentially, you, if you want to kill him, you can kill him anytime you want to, but if you give him the opportunity to become tied to you in your debt and doing work that benefits you, probably that's a better outcome because it's a more considered use of a potentially valuable resource, right? Kit's scientific knowledge and scientific acumen are not necessarily something that it makes sense from a value maximizing perspective to just throw away. And I don't know. I think there might be maybe I'm giving too much credit here, but I think that there's some of a sense in which there's a little bit of either a, like, you could also ask, why doesn't he just kill everyone in the whole Traverse family, right? And to some extent, I think it's from some version of conscientiousness, right? Maybe that's too kind, right? And there might be a certain amount of PR involved in it too, you know? I mean, it's one thing to kill someone who is, to be fair, like, you know, working violently against your interests, and it's another thing to kill
his entire family.
People that are his entire family, right?
Right.
Yeah. Mm.
Interesting.
Cool.
Well, okay. So just for listeners' convenience, we've been talking about Thomas Pynchon's Against the Day, you know, and there it's a huge, crazy novel that's hard to pin down in a lot of ways. You know, we did kind of talk about it structurally. We talked about it, you know, narrative anarchism. Maybe it's epistemological anarchism, which was definitely a cool little addition from Chris. And, you know, I feel like this has actually been a really good discussion insofar as it certainly illuminated things about the text that I was wondering about and was, you know, kind of like, while I was listening to it, like, man, what the fuck, you know, what's going on? So I reckon a discussion successful if something like that happens. So,
yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. Though I, you know, for you, Hans, I feel like you knew everything about it. So I don't know how much, or at least my input, you know, eliminated for you. But that being said, readers, or excuse me, listeners, you know, tune in next time. We didn't
pick a book.
Talk about the next book, and it's my turn, because you guys swapped, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. So I will admit that this pick is totally like a reaction to Against the Day. So like this, it's a reaction in that, you know, I kind of after listening to this, I'm exhausted and I just want to read like a good story. So I'm choosing The Sea Wolf by Jack London.
Oh, that's a great one.
Is it?
I love that book.
Awesome. You know, when I was younger, I listened to Call of the Wild and White Fang, thought they were awesome, and I kind of wanted to revisit that and see, like, is Jack London actually like a good writer, or is he just known for, you know, these adventure stories? And I'm interested in kind of thinking about that.
Well, Jack London is a real interesting contradiction because he had socialist sympathies, but he was also a real individualist.
Mm, yeah.
And that a lot of that, I seem to remember some of that coming forward in The Sea Wolf.
Okay. Cool.
But yeah, good choice.
All right. Well, maybe one of these times I won't pick one that you've read. I feel like, what was my last pick? Frankenstein?
I think most of the ones you picked I haven't read.
It's just been a couple here? Okay.
Just a couple.
All right. So, yeah, The Seawolf, Jack London. Shorter, not as exhausting, hopefully. All right, listeners. Peace out until next time.